Now, the first of three talks this week by Adrian Mole. These were written by Sue Townsend, with Christmas time in mind, and performed by Nicholas Barnes. It's actually Boxing Day as far as Adrian is concerned, and this was first broadcast on Radio 4 on Christmas Day in 1985.
I would like to thank the BBC for inviting me to talk to you on Radio 4. Before I begin properly, I'd just like to take this opportunity to reassure my parents that I got here safely. Hello, Mum. Hello, Dad. The train was okay, but I had to stand in second class. So I went into first class, sat down and pretended to be a lunatic. Fortunately, the ticket inspector has got a lunatic in his family, so he was quite sympathetic and took me to sit on a stool in the guard's van. As you know, I'm normally an introvert, so pretending to be a lunatic extrovert for an hour and 20 minutes wore me out. And I was glad when the train steamed into the cavernous monolith that is St. Pancras Station. Well, to be quite honest, the train didn't steam in, because as you, Dad, will know, steam has been phased out and is now but an erotic memory in a train spotter's head. Anyway, I got a taxi like you told me, a black one with a high roof. I got in and said, "Take me to the BBC." The driver said, "Which BBC?" in a surly sort of tone. I nearly said, "I don't like your tone, my man." But I bit my tongue back and explained. "I am speaking on Radio 4, he said. "Good job you ain't going on the telly with your face." He must have been referring to the bits of green toilet paper sticking to my shaving cuts. I didn't know what to say to his cruel remark, so I kept quiet and watched the money clock like you told me to do. A bloke in a general's uniform barred my way to the hallowed portals of Broadcasting House. He said, "And who might you be, sunshine?" I said, quite coldly, because once again I didn't care for his tone, "I am Adrian Mole, the diarist and juvenile philosopher." He turned to another general. In fact, thinking about it, he could have been the director general, because this second general looked sort of noble, yet careworn. Anyway, the first general shouted, "Look on the list under Mole, will ya?" The second general replied in cultivated tones, so it must have been the director general. "Yes, I've got a mole on the list, Studio B198. Before I knew it, a wizened-up old guide appeared at my elbow and showed me into a palatial lift. Then, once out of the lift, which was twice as big as my bedroom, by the way, he took me down tortured, turning corridors. It was like George Orwell's Ministry of Truth in that book about 1984. Talk about a maze! No wonder DJs are always late turning up for work. Eventually, exhausted and panting, we arrived outside the door of Studio B198. I was a bit worried about the old guide. To tell you the truth, I thought he'd force me to give him mouth-to-mouth, such was his feeble condition. I really think that the BBC ought to provide oxygen on each floor for their older employees, and a trained nurse wouldn't be a bad idea either. It would save them money in the long, scruffy, in fact. He looks like he writes. You know, with a beard and heavy horn-rimmed glasses. Need I say more? I'd better stop talking to you now, Mum and Dad, because he's making rude signs at me through the glass. So much for the standard of education at the BBC. Well, I'd better start properly now. I've got my notes somewhere. Oh, dear. I've left them in the taxi. Oh, well. It's quite lucky that I'm good at doing ad hoc spontaneous talking, isn't it? So, art and culture, are they important? Well, I think art and culture are important, dead important. Without art and culture, we would descend to the level of animals who aimlessly fill their time by hanging around dustbins and getting into fights. The people who don't allow art and culture into their lives can always be spotted. They're pale from watching too much television, and also their conversation lacks a certain je ne sais quoi, unless they're French, of course. Cultureless people talk about the price of turnips and why bread always falls on the buttered side and other such inane things. You never hear them mention Van Gogh or Rembrandt or Bacon. By Bacon, I'm talking about Francis Bacon, the infamous artist. I don't mean streaky or Danish bacon, the sort you eat. No, such names mean nothing to cultureless people. They will never pilgrimage to the Louvre Museum to see Michelangelo's Mona Lisa, nor will they thrill to a Brahms opera. They will fill their empty days with frivolous frivolity and eventually die never having tasted the sweet ambrosia of culture. I therefore feel it incumbent upon me to promote artisticness wherever I tread. If I meet a low-browed person, I force them into a philosophical conversation. I ask them, why are we here? Often their answers are facetious. For instance, last week I asked a humble market trader that very question. He answered, I don't know why you're here, mate, but I'm here to flog carrots. Such people are to be pitied. We, of superior intellect, must not judge them too harshly, but gently nudge them into the direction of the theatre rather than the betting shop, the art gallery instead of the bingo hall, the local madrigal society as opposed to the discotheque. I know that there are cynics who say England is governed by Philistines, so what do you expect? But to these cynics I say, yes, we may be governed by Philistines at the moment, but I'd like to take this opportunity to talk about a political part of relations of bickering about Aunt Ethel's will and why Norman didn't deserve to get the scabby old clock, a general feeling of ennui. Ennui is French for bored out of your skull, by the way. Yes, ennui hangs around the house like stale fag smoke. Anyway, it was Boxing Day, and my girlfriend, Pandora Braithwaite, had come round so that we could exchange belated Christmas greetings. Her family took her to stay in a hotel for Christmas because Mrs. Braithwaite said that if she had to stare up the rear end of another turkey, she would go berserk and stick the parson's nose up Mr. Braithwaite's rear end. Anyway, we exchanged presents. I gave her a fish ashtray I made in pottery at school, and she gave me a Marks and Spencer's voucher so that I can replace my old underpants. The elastic's gone. Yes. So, we thanked each other and kissed for about 5 minutes. Then, I started to talk about my aspirations, and Pandora smoked one of her stinking French fags and listened to me with grave attention. I spoke passionately about beauty and elegance and bringing back the old branch lines on the railways. I thundered against tower blocks and leisure centres and ended by saying, Pandora, my love, will you join me in my life's work? Pandora moved languidly on my bed and said, You haven't said what your life's work is yet, Cherie. I stood over her and said, Pandora, my life's work is the pursuit of beauty. My God, darling, I don't know what's going to happen to you. I pulled her into my arms and reassured her about my future. I said, The way ahead may be stony, but I will walk it barefoot if necessary. Our oblique conversation was interrupted by my mother making mundane inquiries about how many spoons of sugar Pandora took in her cocoa. After my mother had stamped off down the stairs, I turned in despair and cried, Oh, save me from the petty bourgeoisie with their inane inquiries about beverages. We tried to continue the conversation, but it was again interrupted when my father went into the bathroom and started making disgusting grunting noises. He is so uncouth. He can't wash his face without sounding like two warthogs mating in a watering hole. How I managed to spring from his loins, I'll never know. In fact, I sometimes think that it wasn't his loins I sprang from. My mother was once very friendly with a poet. Not a full-time poet, he was a maggot farmer during the day, but at night, after the maggots had been shut up in their sheds, he would pull a pad of Basildon Bond towards him and write poems, quite good poems as well. One of them got into the local paper. My mother cut it out and kept it. Surely the action of a woman in his, aren't I? The poetry, for instance? My mother said, You're nothing like him at all. He was witty and clever and unconventional, and he made me laugh. Also, he was 6 foot tall and devastatingly handsome. So why didn't you marry him, I asked. My mother sighed and sat down on my bed next to Pandora. Well, I couldn't stand the maggots. In the end, I gave him an ultimatum. "Ernie," I said, "it's me or the maggots. You must choose between us." And he chose the maggots. Her lips started to tremble, and so I left the room and bumped into my father on the landing. By now, I was determined to sort out my paternity, so I quizzed him about Ernie Crabtree. "Yeah, Ernie's done well for himself," he said. "They call him the Maggot King in fishing circles. He's got a chain of maggot farms now, and a mansion with a pack of Dobermans running in the grounds. Yeah, good old Ernie." "Does he still write poetry?" I inquired. "Listen, son," said my father, and bent so close that I could see his 30-year-old acne scars. "Listen, Ernie's bank statements are pure poetry. He doesn't need to write the stuff." My father got into bed, took his vest off, and reached for the best-selling book he was reading. Myself, I never read bestsellers on principle. It's a good rule of thumb. If the masses like it, then I'm sure that I won't. "Dad," I said, "what did Ernie Crabtree look like?" My father cracked the spine of his book open, lit a disgusting fag, and said, "Short fat bloke with a glass eye. Wore a ginger wig. Now clear off, I'm reading." I went back to my room to find Pandora and my mother having one of those sickening talks that women have nowadays. It was full of words like unfulfilled, potential, and identity. Pandora kept chipping in with environment and socio-economic and chauvinistic attitude. I got my pyjamas out of my drawer, signalling that I wished their conversation to desist. But neither of them took the hint, so I was forced to change in the bathroom. When I came back, the air was full of French cigarette smoke, and they were gassing about the common market and the relevance of something called milk quotas. I hung about tidying my desk and folding my clothes, but eventually I was forced to climb into bed while the conversation continued on either side of me. When they got onto cruise missiles, I was forced to intercept and plead for a bit of multilateral peace. Fortunately, the dog got into a fight with a gang of dogs outside in the street, so my mother was forced to run outside and separate it from the other canines with a mop handle. I took this opportunity to speak to Pandora. I said, "While you have been idly chatting with my mother, I have been formulating important ideas. I have decided that I am going to organize a party." Pandora said, "Hey, Tasty, a fancy dress party?" "No," I shouted, "I'm forming a political party." "Well, more of a movement, really. It will be called the Mole Movement, and membership will be £2 a year." Pandora asked what she would get for £2 a year. I replied, "Arresting conversation and stimulation and stuff." She opened her mouth to ask another question, so I closed my eyes and feigned sleep. I heard the squelch of Pandora's moon boots as she tiptoed to the door, opened it, and went off squelching down the stairs. Thus was the Mole Movement born.
Adrian Mole was written by Sue Townsend, performed by Nicholas Barnes, and produced by John Tidyman.